Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, April 9th, Joe was joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, Corporate Attorney at Phillips Lytle, LLP, Rich Honan, Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House Advance Lead, Anna Markowitz, and Albany Mayor, Kathy Sheehan.
The latest headline is that the trade war is escalating as China hits back again at the U.S. Beijing announces an 84% levy on U.S. goods. Markets are faltering. Of course, we'll know more at 9:30 when the Dow opens. China retaliated with more tariffs after President Trump imposed a 104% tariff on Chinese goods. Europe was poised to approve a plan to retaliate as well. Europe has been a little bit slow. We've been wondering what Europe has been up to, and now they are say that they are prepared. So this all intensifies as China announced the additional levies. This is just hours after the punishing new tariffs actually took effect. Stocks and bonds slumped on the move, which heightened fears of a global recession as the EU prepared its own retaliation for U.S. steel and aluminum tariffs. Mr. Trump's latest tariffs hit nearly all U.S. trading partners with new levies and raised import taxes on Chinese goods to 104%. Beijing then announced additional tariffs on imports from the United States for a total levy of 84% to go into effect within hours. We have been talking about the story since late last Wednesday when the original announcement was made on quote-unquote Liberation Day. And since then, things have been, quite frankly, all over the place. And we've been watching this. This from the, let me just bring this up if I can get it, which is, I wanted to get, there's a thing in the Wall Street Journal that I wanted to pick up.
While you're looking for that, Joe, the European Union just announced that they are imposing up to a 25% levy on broad list of U.S. goods. So the war has expanded from China to the European Union.
So a lot going on, and we'll talk about this big banks reckoning with this, what's going on as well. Jamie Dimon saying that he believes a recession is likely, and China has readied a trade war arsenal that takes aim at U.S. companies. So all of this happening. And meanwhile, as of 1 minute ago, the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, says the economy is in good shape. All right. Rich, what do you think?
Oh, we're starting with me.
We're going to start with you.
I think it's as promised, probably a little more exciting than promised. I think that this tumult is going to go on. If it's still going on 2 quarters from now, that would be very bad. I would like to think that within a quarter, we will have reached deals with a good amount of nations. I don't know. I don't know if the EU deals are going to be with the EU or bilateral deals with the member states. It's messy. And of course, it's on top of the whole idea of, kind of slimming down the government. And one of the things that we conservatives kind of like to skip over is we all decry government spending, but you got to remember it drives a really big part of our, 20% of the U.S. like GDP or something. And so while we do want to reduce government spending and while we do want to get more free trade, freer trade, there's a cost. And right now we're seeing the cost.
I have two quick follow-up questions for you. One is, did we have to have tumult? Was tumult always going to be a part of the equation? Did it have to be that way?
First of all, even Trump is everything Trump does is Tymult, right? Yeah, so that you know, but you know, I kind of assume that going in. And my answer is yeah. I think if you're going to try and pursue disruptive policy, whether it's in trade, whether it's in social, whether it's in fiscal, I think it has to it's got to be a little messy because we've learned that incrementalism. And I'm not quoting Martin Luther King in his speech, but you know the what does he call it, the cooling elixir of incrementalism. Yeah. You know that hasn't worked when it comes to making fiscal policy.
Final question before we move on to other members of the
I'm
group
leave
here.
After this,
you
which,
no, you're not. As you have come to us for a very very long time as a tech attorney and helping tech startups, and I'm just curious, is that a sector, is your job fundamentally changed by anything that is going on right now?
No, not at all. But to be fair, though, a lot of the companies at the startup level, you know, they're kind of beneath these waves. You know what I mean? I mean, they're looking for disruptive right. technologies. And really, the more world tumult there is, the more opportunities they see. But a startup by definition isn't usually, they're not importing goods yet or anything like that. Now, I assume if it turns into a real recession and employment gets difficult, then it might. But so far, no.
So there's nothing discouraging in what they're seeing.
Oh, I'm sure politically they might think so.
Sure.
But no, I think... you know, I'll defer to the mayor on this, but I think we still see a lot of good startup activity coming out of our region between the colleges and kind of the supports the ecosystem.
Yeah, I think that the concern is that, and maybe you know, investor dollars will be directed there more so because of the tumultuous situation on Wall Street. So that kind of remains to be seen. But I think that's the one concern is where is the investment going to come from? You know, a lot of what we've been looking to do here in Albany, particularly with the work that Chuck Schumer did to get the national, you know, lab here, is dependent on other countries coming and using this space as a place for really the world to develop the next generation of chips and the next generation of technology. So it'll be interesting to see what happens on the international level with respect to those expectations.
I agree. And let me just say one more thing. And you know, the mayor brings up a good point. And I think what is going to hurt startup activity, not so much on the tariff side, but on the reduction of grant money, you know, something near and dear to everybody's heart, as well as my daughter's, right? But now that is a place between, you know, you find a lot of startups between, you know, the NIH grants and DARPA and ARPA and you know, and all those. And I actually think that might have more of a chilling effect because so many of them, you know, kind of get a little push from, you know, some portion of a grant. And when those grants are held up, I think if that's where you're going
right.
with that, I very much agree.
And they start in our universities, and our universities are being hit. Some of the, you know, really most prestigious research institutions and research universities are being hit. And so I think that is a real threat with respect to advancements in all types of technologies, not just tech, but the medical sector, pharmaceuticals, you know, you name it. So
Fiber.
I think it remains to be seen what's going to happen there.
So can I ask Rich a question? Rich, as a conservative, do you support the tariffs then?
I support the use of tariffs as a policymaking technique. I don't support the use of tariffs from an economic standpoint necessarily because I get who eventually pays. But, you know, if the goal here is reducing China's influence, and if the goal here is in decoupling, making it so China can't be the party along with India, who's buying the energy from Russia that other people aren't buying, if that's the goal, then I do support using economic means rather than, I won't go as far as military, but by using other means. And I happen to think that's the eventual goal, is we're trying to change behavior by using economic leverage.
So
to that extent, I support.
So the idea of the tariffs on Canada and EU and the penguins and everything else.
I think that I would agree. Again, if those tariffs, if we're still in the same position 3 months from now, a quarter from now, then I would agree with you. I think there's going to be some tumult. I'd like to think that once we start cutting deals, you know, Japan, South Korea, who was ever, you know, first on the list, maybe Great Britain, you know, not a member of the EU or England, then I'd like to think that things will start to calm down. But I think the, quote, trade war with China is a calculated thing. And I'd rather be fighting China with money than, you know, if they land in Taiwan.
Yeah, and I'd rather be fighting China with our allies rather than alone. And I think, you know, I'm worried, you know, there seems to be this feeling that all these deals are going to get cut. And I'm looking at the situation out there and I'm thinking, A, why would you trust this administration? I mean, he's made deals that he hasn't followed in the past. And also, where is the off-ramp on this war? I mean, who blinks first, and how do they do it without looking weak or without jeopardizing their own domestic authority? And that's what really worries me, is that I see things ramping up, and I see the rhetoric, and I see the insults that we're hurling even at our own allies. And if you're a leader of these other countries, how do you blink without the ire of your own people being levied against you?
By both sides blinking. That, I mean,
this is it. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, both sides are going to have to blink.
I don't think that he's either. I think he's too arrogant and not smart enough to blink. And I think that the other world leaders now are looking at a change in the fundamental relationship that we've enjoyed for many, many decades. And maybe they don't need to cut a deal with us because we're no longer something that can be trusted.
But the fundamental relationship for many decades, and I keep saying I'm going to stop, so I will stop.
No, you're fine.
The foundation of the relationship for too many years has been the United States paying for a lot of initiatives that either the EU or NATO pays lip service to, but we end up paying. And that's, to me, that's kind of an overriding policy. And I don't think that Trump was reticent about making that an issue. That's one of the things I voted for. And I think he blinks a lot more than you give him credit for. I think, in fact, during the first term, he was pilloried for being too transactional. You know, he would do this, and then he would change his mind and do this. I think he's coachable, and I think he wants to do a deal. I think he really, really, really wants to avoid military intervention at almost any cost.
I mean, Mayor. I think you're giving him a tremendous amount of credit, but I think this is classic Trump. I mean, this is what he does. This is how he does business. This shouldn't surprise anyone. I mean, for those who say, you know, oh, this is happening. I think he was emboldened by the stance that he took with NATO in 2017-18 in his first term. And I think that it did result in our allies doing more, and that this status quo that you talk about, right, this is kind of the way things were. And, you know, the U.S. has probably always carried more than what Trump considers it to be our fair share, and maybe conservatives think to be our fair share. And so, you know, this is he wants to upset the status quo. He thinks that this is going to work, and, you know, that this is his style. And the unknown, right, is we don't know how it's going to play out. We don't know the impact that it's going to have. And he doesn't really seem to care.
No.
Right. So this is how he does business. It's why seven of his businesses went bankrupt. And so we're watching in real time. And he's surrounded by some people who are telling him this is the dumbest idea in the world, and others who I don't think are are coaching him, or you said he's coachable. I think they're just along for the ride, whatever he says goes, and they're just sycophants, and they're going to say, yes, sir. So I think this is him. This is his gut, and we'll see whether we end up with bankrupt casinos in Atlantic City or, you know, an economy that is stronger.
Anna?
I think I'm not surprised by the tactics. We all expected deal making. I'm surprised as to the tools that he's able to use to get this done. I personally didn't see him being able to declare national emergencies for every single topic that he finds, you know, inconvenient. The fact that he can say, oh, a trade deficit that's been going on since 1975 is a national emergency. What? You can take away Congress's ability to issue tariffs and be able to do that completely unilaterally because of just some statement that you made? Can you make that for any statement? Are we going to do this for daylight savings time because we don't like that? Like, what is the limit? It just seems crazy.
That was Anna Markowitz on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, April 9th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, April 10th, Joe was joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
For those of you who left, were with us till the end of the show yesterday, there were still tariffs in place, and they had only been in place for about less than 12 hours, I think 8 hours or so, when we left the airwaves, and maybe 10 hours. And then we were talking about how these were going to continue, and we had a conversation about how there was going to be no negotiation. They were not going to negotiate that. These were going to be for the long haul. We were going to see what happened. Then on yesterday afternoon, mid-afternoon, the president reversed course on global tariffs and announced a 90-day pause. So the 10% tariffs that went in place earlier yesterday were then put on pause for 90 days, with the exception of China. And just hours after he put those levies into place on nearly 60 countries, the announcement came out that there would be a pause for 90 days. Mr. Trump did not extend that pause to China, opting instead to raise tariffs again on all Chinese imports, bringing those taxes to a whopping 125%. That decision came after Beijing raised its levies on American goods to 84% on Wednesday afternoon in an escalating tit-for-tat between the world's largest economies. In a post on Truth Social, the president said he had authorized a 90-day pause, shouty caps, all capitalized, P-A-U-S-E, pause, in which countries would face a substantially lowered reciprocal tariff of 10%. As a result, nearly every U.S. trading partner now faces a 10% blanket tariff on top of 25% tariffs that Mr. Trump has imposed on cars, steel, and aluminum. Slumping markets quickly rallied after Mr. Trump's post. The S&P 500 climbed several percentage points in just a matter of minutes and closed with a rise of more than 9%, sharply reversing days and days of losses. Wednesday was the best day for the S&P 500 since the recovery from the 2008 financial crisis. Nearly every stock in the index rose, airlines, some tech companies, even Tesla were among those companies to soar over 20%. Shares of automakers rose sharply, even though 25% tariffs on imported cars remain in place. Ford and General Motors both rose more than 7%. Mr. Trump, who for days had insisted he was not concerned about the market rout, acknowledged on Wednesday that the downturn had led into the decision. Here's the quote. "Over the last few days, it looked pretty glum," Mr. Trump said. "I thought the people were jumping a little bit out of line," he said in explaining his decision. "They were getting yippy.
Yippy.
They were getting a little bit afraid. You know, yippy."
All right. So he went to the Wharton School and learned that.
Mr. Trump's change in course came amid a sharp sell-off in U.S. government bond markets and the dollar, which are typically seen as the safest corner for investors during times of turmoil. Investors large and small had watched trillions in stock market value vanish in just a matter of days. Asked Wednesday if the bond market reaction had caught his attention, Mr. Trump said he noticed over the weekend that investors were getting queasy. That from the New York Times. Now to our panel. Would you like to start off, Judy?
So 3.5 years to go, you know. Oh, no, more than 3.5 years to go. So I tend to look at I'm an observer of spin and how the news covers things. And it's been interesting to watch people, you know, contort themselves like pretzels to try to explain this mass tariff imposition that he announced a week ago on Liberation Day. And then to watch as he flip-flopped on it, and then to watch, I mean, for Fox News, for example, really hasn't been covering the last week of stock market turmoil. They've been focused on crazy stuff, you know, that really no mention. They you can hear it on some of the late night programs, but even today they're still not focusing on it. And I want to make the point that, like, it's interesting when it comes to spin. We talked about the stock market having a great day yesterday. Well, they still took my $10 investment. They drew it down to $6, and now it's back up to $8, and I'm supposed to be happy. I mean, there are still tariffs out there that need to be discussed. And also, this is only a 90-day pause, so it leaves the uncertainty everywhere. There's so much news to cover on this front. You need to explain what tariffs are. I mean, I don't think the bond market has ever gotten this much attention, and people explaining how bonds work. So I think we just need to take everything with a grain of salt. And I think if anything, it reinforces the fact that you really can't trust that this administration knows what it's doing, because Trump himself said yesterday it's kind of a gut thing when he decides what to do. I'd love to see his college transcripts from Wharton to see how he actually did. I imagine all his professors have passed by now since he's an older man, but we've never really known how he did in that famous business school down in New Jersey.
Well, don't get too comfortable about yesterday's increase in the stock market, because it's already giving back a huge amount this morning. So on the futures, or Dow futures, were down about 500 a few minutes ago. So, yeah, he wants to get yippy. He doesn't want to get jiggy. That's Will Smith. That's another one. I tell you what.
Nice, Ira. Very good.
What really bothered me, there's so many things, as Judy says, to so many different angles you can go at, but one of the things that really bothered me about this is the uninformed sense of where they're coming from, they meaning Trump, as it relates to what this reaction would be among people who are losing money. In other words, he and the billionaire class can get by with a few days of the stock market going way down and a few months of uncertainty. Most people in this country, particularly those who have 401ks, can't. This is their life. This is their retirement. And I just don't get the sense that, that there's a connect there between Trump and whoever is advising him, and that group of people who they can't relate to. I mean, there's just no, there's no kinship between the White House and the public, it appears to me.
Well, and that the kinship comes from, I would assume, how do I say this? If you had a solid plan and you knew what you were doing, and I just don't know if that exists.
Yeah, well,
right?
You know, to Judy's point about him and his grades and his professors, he doesn't have a sterling history of being a good businessman. His admonitions to the contrary, but you know, the casino is always topic A. How could you lose money running
right.
a casino? And he managed to do that and take five or six other bankruptcies too.
Malia.
The most excellent bankruptcies.
Yeah, they're
the
actually
most outstanding.
They're a big, beautiful bill. That's
yeah.
another one.
Yeah.
I feel
it's a beautiful word bankruptcy.
Yeah. It's almost as if he set fire to a house and then wants to be congratulated for calling the fire department. But the house is still burned, even though the fire department managed to save. You know, it's also I feel like the rest of the world is starting to feel a little bit of the sort of whiplash that we in the United States have felt over. It's only been a couple months now. So let me talk a little bit about China in particular. Or did you want to save that for?
No,
next?
Go ahead.
Okay.
No.
So because. Everything has been more or less reversed except for China, which the tariffs have actually been increased. So they're over 100% now. I go to China every year. I studied Chinese in college. I've been traveling there for 30 years. And it was interesting. Last year when I was in China, I met a businessman who is based out of a relatively prosperous eastern coastal city. And he owned a series of factories throughout China. And this was in June, and he was planning. He had a plan at that point. He knew that if Trump were elected, that Trump would probably bring in even more tariffs. So he had a plan. How is he going to survive the potential of Trump tariffs? He's going to move all of his factories from China to other countries in Southeast Asia. And once Trump was elected, he immediately did that. And almost a dozen factories just moved out of China to Vietnam, Malaysia and Thailand, I believe. And so it's just an example of how, you know, in China, there are lots of rich people, too, and they can move in ways that they can avoid the pain of these tariffs as well. So tariffs on both sides of the ocean, this has been said many times before, they tend to affect the most vulnerable. I'm sure this businessman was kicking himself yesterday, though, because Vietnam originally was on the list of countries that was going to receive, you know, huge tariffs, and he had moved a bunch of his factories there. Just to remind folks that during the first Trump administration, Trump started what was then called a trade war with China and imposed a bunch of tariffs. And at the end of the Trump administration, there was already a sort of a 20% tariff on Chinese goods across the board. And Biden kept that in place and actually added a few more to that. So it's not like we were starting from zero. But there are a number of reasons, I think, that China has been a particular target. And some of them are connected to the market and others aren't. China continues to be the major supplier of fentanyl. That's the United States. And so opioid busts, I mean, there's a lot of data that shows this fentanyl flow from China. I find it astonishing, though, the different Trump administration approaches to fentanyl as a problem in international affairs, that putting a lot of tariffs on China is how he's handling it in the one hand. And then for a tiny, 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 tiny amount of fentanyl that was found crossing the border from Canada, he was joking about annexing Canada. It's a very inconsistent,
right,
to put it mildly, approach.
Oh, sorry, we're blowing.
No, we're
past
going.
The,
you're
yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
No, I didn't want to.
Going past the break again.
I just texted and said, Malia's on a roll.
Oh.
We're gonna hold off.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So that's part of it, and so this the Congress during the first Trump administration held hearings about the fentanyl problem with China, and there has been a little bit of improvement. Ironically. You know, there was no law enforcement cooperation between the U.S. and China on this subject, even though opioid deaths, it's a leading cause of death in the United States. There was no law enforcement cooperation until the Biden administration. And now, because of these tariffs, that kind of law enforcement cooperation is probably dead in the water, even though the problem of fentanyl is one of the reasons these tariffs are put in place. So it just makes it less likely they're going to solve the problem that that is supposedly impelling these tariffs. I think another reason that the Trump is putting them in place, honestly, is a little bit of jealousy of Xi Jinping, who is the kind of autocratic strongman that Trump seems to admire. And even though Xi Jinping is presiding over a Chinese economy that is not in a really strong state right now, I think Trump looks at the growth in military, the consolidation of power by the Chinese Communist Party over the past couple of years as something that is admirable something that he's interested in emulating.
You know, I can only speak for myself, and then certainly not for the nation at large, but it just seems to me that there'd be a lot more confidence among the public in what Trump is doing if Trump had a better history as a businessman. And I mean, he, as I said before, he's got his businesses are littered with failures, The kind of issues that are on play here and the amount of money that's in play here, who'd want to give him the opportunity to steer this ship?
I don't disagree with you one bit, but even if you don't go back and look at his history as a businessman, just over the last 4, 6, 8 weeks, the seesawing, the back and the forth, the back and the forth, the back and the forth. We're going to do this. We're not going to do this. We're going to do this. We're not going to do this. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. The court says no. We're going to do that. So that, I think, is really difficult for, I'm going to say, most of us to completely understand. And I mean, one of the stories that we're talking about, and you touched on it, of course, is that China becomes an alternative because they're not doing that. They have a much more firm and steady hand on the wheel. So it does seem like it has the big question that's being asked this morning and was being asked last night is what is the long-term effect of what happened over the last week? And I don't think we'll know because go ahead.
Well, there are some trends that have already been started. So, as I said, some of these tariffs have already been in place. And so that has the fact that they've ramped up so suddenly, it's just an extreme aspect of something that was already started a while ago. And as a result of these tariffs being in place, the percentage, the market percentage of Chinese exports going to the United States has lowered, and instead they've been really strengthening their trade relationships with the countries, especially in East Asia and Southeast Asia, taking a much greater share of Chinese exports. And this is a region where the United States has wanted to expand its influence, partly because China's been making some really aggressive military moves in the region. And so to help maintain peace and stability, I mean, that is something that has been a priority of multiple U.S. administrations, back of at least a decade. this idea of rebalancing to the Asia Pacific or pivoting to the Asia Pacific, that has been a key foreign policy goal that's been more or less consistent across the United States. And so this tariff, this extreme tariff, is undermining that to a certain extent because it's going to strengthen those trade bonds. And it's hard for countries to make a choice between a strong economic relationship if they have very close trade ties with China and a lot of their economy is tied to that, and then having a security relationship with the United States where the trade relationship isn't as strong.
It's the uncertainty that's such an issue now because the ill will against America is pervasive around the world. And people going to negotiate with the United States, any country that goes, knows that they have to deal directly with Donald Trump. They can't go to the trade representative because apparently he didn't even know this was going to happen. He was out of the loop. Peter Navarro was out of the loop. I mean, they can't trust what they hear from the U.S. government because Donald Trump tends to act erratically, it seems. And going forward, I mean, people are just not going to trust us. And maybe this only lasts 4 years and we go back to some stability after the Trump administration. But the world can't trust that. And when it comes to building manufacturing plants, I mean, those are long-term commitments. And manufacturers around the world are trying to figure out how to proceed and what they can lock in so they can really make business plans.
That was Judy Patrick on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, April 10th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel the week in review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, April 11th, Joe was joined by communications expert and founder president of Stanhope Partners, Bob Bellafiore, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, and chairman and chief investment officer at Hugh Johnson Advisors in Albany, Hugh Johnson.
So, you know, initially there were points, various points in this week, as you know, it's just been all over the place. And at the point when the tariffs were paused and I thought, oh, well, I know Hugh will be on Friday and maybe we can, even though things are cooling down a little bit, we can just sort of look and say, oh, you know, this is the week that we had and get an idea of what that is. And maybe with a couple of days of perspective. But that hasn't been the case, and it was the market went nuts after the announcement, and then yesterday things cooled, and now there's the issues with China raising tariffs on the U.S. to 125%, as the New York Times calls it, a tit-for-tat trade war that is escalating. And that retaliation comes after the White House raised its levy on Chinese goods to 125% on top of an existing 20% tax. There's a point, Hugh Johnson, where I don't even know what that means.
Well, what it means is, of course, is that they're raising tariffs. And if you try to send things to China, there's an import tariff on what you send to China. It becomes more expensive, and the vice versa, obviously. As China sends things here, there's a tariff on what they send here. And so prices, the first thing that happens during a trade war, a tariff trade war, is that we see prices start to go up domestically in the U.S., and we see higher rates of inflation, and that brings all sorts of issues to bear on the course on the Federal Reserve when they see inflation, unfortunately, again starting to rise. So it creates a very difficult situation. I might add that we're talking about, yes, China up to 125% on the U.S. At the same time, in this tit-for-tat world, you're also seeing the U.S. scramble, I guess is the right word, to try to do deals, is the way I think you have to put it right at this point, with 70 other countries which are going to be facing higher tariffs. We're talking about 10% tariffs now. We're not talking about the reciprocal tariffs, which would have been much higher and much more dangerous. But this is the 10% tariffs, and there are a lot of countries that are faced with that, and it's going to be tough for them. And now the administration is trying to, I don't want to use the word, but help those countries by negotiating with those countries. I think the important thing, though, out of all of this, is that the tariffs right now look as though they're being imposed primarily as a negotiating tactic. Yes, we do want higher tariffs, but we don't want significantly higher taxes, tariffs, in order to try to wreak havoc for the not only U.S. economy, but for the global economy. So negotiating tactic, I think that's important, and it's important for lots of reasons.
So I want to get into that and ask a specific question about negotiation. But before I do that, let me just get a big question that I have out of the way more than anything else, which is, this is a pause. It's a 90-day pause. Is that in and of itself problematic? Because it seems that we're pausing a turbulent situation. Does that not just allow us to be in more turbulence for the next 3 months?
Not necessarily, because remember, the administration is trying to negotiate some sort of a tariff with 70 other countries. So during this pause, things are going to get done, hopefully, cross your fingers, and that we're going to negotiate tariffs in a way that tariffs are going to come down and not be as difficult for the global economy.
Is this the way to do that? I mean, is this the model way to do that? You've been in this game for a long time. Have you ever seen anything like this?
Yes, I have seen something like this.
Okay.
And I think I would invite everybody to take a look back at the 2018-2019 trade war. And that played out in a certain way. I call it stage one and stage two. We're still in stage one. But it played out in a way that I think is a good model for what this one's going to play out. And one part of the 2018-2019 trade war, very significant part, was the so-called negotiations that went on at that time primarily between the U.S. and China. So negotiations were a part of that. As a result, it didn't last forever, and we came out of it in reasonably good shape. Negotiations are a part of this, and there's a chance that on the basis of those negotiations we'll come out of this in relatively good shape. And when I say relatively good shape, that won't cause economic havoc in the U.S. as well as the rest of the globe.
I want to let your colleagues in on this discussion in just a moment, but one is there's some question as to what the status is of these negotiations. I understand it's with a lot of countries, but as far as what is actively being done, that still seems to be a question. But then how do you and can you and will they properly, and we can decide what that means properly, negotiate with China?
We've been negotiating with China for a long time. They're very much a part of, the first trade war, 2018-2019, not only a part of it, but they were the principal focus, and we've had tariffs on China ever since then, and including they were extended by the Biden administration. So to China and the U.S., there's going to be the negotiations between China and the U.S., let's just say they're ongoing. And are they going to continue to be ongoing after the so-called 90 days? You bet they'll be ongoing. It's going to be a struggle, which I think, my guess, is that it's going to be ongoing for a long period of time as they both struggle for, let's call it, global leadership.
So go ahead. Teresa Bourgeois.
It's a question. 2018, you mentioned. Can you just, for those who don't know, was it this many? Were there this many countries involved at that time? And were our allies involved to the extent that they are now? I don't recall that. So could you refresh our memory?
It's a great question, Teresa. And I can't really give you a good answer because I didn't look that closely at it, closely enough to say that it was primarily the U.S. and China at that time, although Canada and Mexico were certainly a part of what was going on, the negotiations on tariffs between countries around the world. But it was nowhere near as extensive as this was in the terms of the number of countries, but also importantly, and I think this is well worth keeping in mind, not just simply the number of countries, but the extent of the tariffs themselves. We're talking about 10% universal tariffs now, but the real problem was potentially where the pause is on the reciprocal tariffs, and those were very extensive, so large, and I hate to say this, but so large that they compared with the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of 1930, which led to the Depression.
Right.
And so I think it's both the number of countries as well as the magnitude of the tariffs, which makes this importantly different. But even though it's different, I think it's going to, and this is a little bit subtle, it's going to play out, I think, in somewhat of a similar manner to what happened in 2018-19 as far as what's going to happen to inflation, longer-term interest rates, Federal Reserve policy, stock prices in phase one, and then we have stage two, what's going to happen during that stage, where then we'll start to see inflation coming down, we'll see the Federal Reserve reducing rates, long rates coming down, and stock prices, surprisingly, doing well in stage two of this trade war. I'm hoping that the model works this time, despite the fact that there are more countries and more significant tariffs.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Just one question, and then, yeah. Yes, absolutely, really of course. But I a follow-up. But so you the way you talk about this is in very measured tones, and thankfully, because you make me feel better. But I will say as you described this, it seems as though there was some master plan that was afoot, and that this was put into action, and this was exactly what we were expecting. As I sat here and panels sat here over the last couple of days, it didn't feel like that. It felt like it was just the Wild West, and we were, this had happened one minute, this would happen the next minute, and we were all over the place. So are both things true?
Master plan. A master plan in the mind of Donald Trump. That's the extent of the master plan. He's been absorbed by, or obsessed by, is probably the right word, the idea of tariffs and equalizing or leveling out the playing field, as he would say. It was completely misguided, but nevertheless, leveling the playing field. And that's been in his mind. But then there have been a few people that have been involved with him that have sort of structured all of the tariffs, talked about, I mentioned the 10% universal, I mentioned the reciprocal tariffs, who structured that, and you saw that long list of countries with their current imports and exports or their tariffs, and then the tariffs that we would impose as a part of the reciprocal tariffs. That was so misguided. It almost takes words out of my mouth. But anyway, all of that was kind of an on-again, off-again, here we are, and there we are, and was concocted, I think, as best I can guess, was concocted as a sort of a last-minute thing by some people that were not particularly, didn't have extensive experience in the whole subject of tariffs. He had a person working for him in this first administration, Robert Lighthizer, who was really good at this. And he has a couple of people at the Secretary of the Treasury. I think it's pretty competent. He has some people, but overall, candidly, from what little I know, and I know a little bit more, but from what I do know, I'm certainly not overly impressed with the way the reciprocal tariffs were put together or figured out or mathematically composed.
Teresa.
Well, the other question, this is a world I just don't know, so these are really questions. I'm trying, but the long list question, because there is 3 months, so that's a pause that's important. But as I was reading, each one of these is a complex trade negotiation. And can you really deal with 70 countries individually, set up separate deals in just 3 months? And particularly with, it seems like the advisors are going in 3 or 4 different directions. Well, the trade rep seems to be out of the loop. Bessent's going in one direction, 2 of the others in a different. So how do you really, in 3 months, when you have 70 different countries, do that?
You're absolutely right. They cannot be done in 3 months or 90 days. That's not enough time. But you can reach a memo of understanding between yourselves, U.S., and that country to sort of start or launch the most important phase, which is when the actual deal or tariffs are put together, negotiated and put together. And hopefully, and this is what you hope for, is that there's a memo of understanding which leads to some sort of a give or reduction, and sensible reduction, in the level of the tariffs, so it's not going to have significant inflation and economic damage. That's the first thing you hope for. And then, of course, you go through the process of negotiating it and get an agreement. Is it going to be done? It can be done, but it's going to take a very long time. First, you get the agreement, the memo of understanding. That's number one. That can be done in 90 days. And then you got to move on to the actual tough part, which is actually negotiating the tariffs, which are extraordinarily complex, especially when you get past the tariff stage and you get into things like the VAT taxes and you get into things like currency manipulation. Then it becomes extraordinarily complex, difficult to, for me and most people, to understand.
Bob Bellafiore.
Boy, I love going after this because I have to keep a mental list of all the things I want to talk about. Hugh, you said people are going to, if you were expecting any kind of stability, right? There is no stability when Donald Trump is around. He is a large rear fin on a great white shark. He does nothing but do this all the time and agitates the waters.
You're moving your hand to the left and the right.
Yeah. I'm being like a rear fin of a,
yeah,
of a,
so that's
a
right.
great white
His
shark.
His hand. He's moving.
Right.
You did describe it well.
Yeah. I mean, he is always agitating. He is always poking beehives. That is the way he has always been. He is, as Saul Alinsky would say, he is flooding the zone with stuff. Right? Hugh, you hit the nail on the head when you said this is a negotiation, right? And in a negotiation, right, you've been in high-stakes financial negotiations. Everybody has bought a house. You know what it's like. In a governmental political context, one, you can juggle 70 balls at once. You have to when you're the White House in the United States, because all of these things are like a giant spider web, right? That's what geopolitical economics and everything is. It's a giant spider web. You pull one thread, the other thread moves. They're all interacting. You can't deal with any one in isolation because they all have reverberations on other things. The way negotiations work is, and I learned this best from 8 years with Governor Pataki, you decide where you want to go. What does victory look like? What does the end look like? And then you start on that path. You propose a way, other people propose a way. And people do things in the midst of it, and you need to constantly adapt to what other people do. But it's a negotiation. If you pay attention to every little step in a negotiation, you will be, Joel, like you said, people were this week, feeling like it's not good, right? Feelings are irrational, right? Feelings are, and part of the problem with the country.
Or maybe it's not. Oh, sorry.
Part of the problem with the United States right now is people are so focused on feelings. Right. I'm not trying to be hard-hearted, but, you know, it doesn't feel right to me. Well, fine. You know,
well,
preparing for a colonoscopy doesn't feel right to me either.
I mean, they're worried about their Social Security. They're worried about their 401Ks, their 403Bs. They're worried about their future. They're worried about their retirement. They're worried about their kids, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
So I think it's more than a feeling. I think it's.
Well, what's
it's
worry? Worry is a feeling.
Yeah. No, but I think it's genuine
based in
fear.
Facts.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, I mean, farmers.
It's a feeling.
Here's
some
facts,
something.
Bob.
Let me say, their feelings are a big part of this, but obviously that makes it very soft and elusive and difficult to sort of pin down as to what we're talking about. I've always found in my profession that the financial markets or investors collectively, not individually, but collectively, often get it right. In other words, they get it right as to where we're headed for the economy. And where we're headed for inflation and where we're headed for Federal Reserve policy. So what I'm just simply saying is that, you know, I understand it's elusive, but at the same time, if you want to sort of quantify where we're headed, where the U.S. is headed, where the global economy is headed, where things are headed, take a look at the performance of the financial markets. Well, financial markets will probably get it right. It won't be immediate, but it'll probably, I know. Like I saw
okay,
this
but
chart. That's,
can I ask then?
Yeah, you bet.
Because I heard people talking about this last night. Again, not an expert, so I'm trying to read. And the bond markets are doing something that they don't typically do. Typically, when you have a stock sell-off, people move to safety and bonds. But they are not, which the experts that I listened to last night said, and I'd like to hear you on this because I'm not, said that's a really serious warning sign. It says that they have lost confidence in the dollar. and so that they are not buying treasuries. And is it not unusual to not go to bonds when you're selling stocks? No, and that's a serious, scary signal.
It is a little bit troubling, but it's not that troubling if you think about it. And that is, when you see the financial markets performing, which, as you're describing, where stocks are going down, bonds are going up, and interest rates are coming down. And we've seen that periodically over the last month or so. The message from the financial markets collectively, and that's important, not only stocks going down, but you see interest rates going down, and periodically we've had that. We've also had the opposite, but we've had that. What that message is fairly clear, is that investors are very concerned that something fundamental is happening, and it raises significant dangers for the U.S. economy. What it really effectively means is that stocks are going down because the economy will suffer and earnings will do poorly. That's part of the story. But it's also saying that that interest rates are going down because in time, what's going to happen with interest rates going down is the reflection of problems in the economy, which means that in time, interest rates are going down, but the Federal Reserve will have to step up and lower short-term interest rates to try to help the economy. And both are very consistent. In other words, stocks going down because of worries and concerns about the economy, and interest rates going down because of deep worries and concerns about the economy. That's what ordinarily happens, especially when those worries and concerns are very deep. If they're not that deep, then you get what you might call normal, which is stocks will go down, but bonds will...
Because they usually go in opposite.
Not always. Look at history.
What if China retaliates by not buying our treasuries, as they typically do?
Well, they typically do, because don't forget...
Don't they hold an enormous amount of our debt?
They hold an enormous amount, which is one of the reasons why they're going to continue to buy U.S. treasuries. In other words, countries that say, gee, we're going to swear off buying treasuries or helping finance. This is an important issue, incidentally. But when they say they're going to swear off buying issues, they're really stuck. They can't really do that. Because if they do that, if China backs away from the markets, or if the European Union backs away from the markets and you have fewer buyers, what is going to happen to interest rates? Interest rates are going to have to find other buyers, or it's going to be difficult, and interest rates are going to go up. Well, who does that hurt? It hurts China. It hurts Europe. It hurts all those people that have been funding or financing our deficits for so long. Now, you raise a really interesting issue because this gets a little bit complex. And that is...
As opposed to the other stuff,
yeah,
which is the easy stuff.
Yeah,
the fuel fly rule.
I really apologize for all that. But at any rate,
helping them immensely.
Well, it's very interesting.
But
and
this
that
idea
is,
that
don't,
China
don't forget,
could...
Don't forget. There's a purpose behind raising money by imposing tariffs. And part of that is to raise revenues for the federal government in Washington. Why are they raising revenues for the federal government? To pay for the tax bill. To pay for the extension of the 2017 tax.
That's what this is all about.
All right.
He's tanking our economy to raise taxes.
That's going to cost $3 trillion over 10 years. Where's that money going to come from? Well, part of it's going to come from U.S. investors, but part of it's going to come from foreign investors. Are foreign investors going to be anxious to step up to the plate and buy U.S. treasuries? This gets to what you're talking about. Are they going to be anxious to step up to the plate and buy U.S. treasuries? Well, probably less so if you're putting tariffs on the products that they're trying to sell to the U.S. So that's a really great question, and it's a really important question. But remember, the purpose of the tariffs, or the ultimate purpose, in my judgment, is to raise revenues, to finance the reduction in taxes, and that's going to be made much more difficult if you're telling those countries that have been financing our deficits, that have been buying our treasuries, that you're going to have to pay big tariffs.
Do we have a timeline on that? Like, how long does that take?
Trump would like to get it done really quickly.
Yes.
Do we have a timeline? It's a guessing game.
Yeah.
It's 10 years of $3 trillion, and that doesn't even count the amount we're going to have to pay in interest over that 10 years, which is $467 billion. These are not my estimates. I wouldn't do that work.
And
it's the Congressional Budget Office.
That was Hugh Johnson on the Roundtable Panel on Friday, April 11th. Full episodes of the Roundtable Panel are available online at WAMC.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.